You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, when a police officer is confronted, how close is too close? Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake says it's time for a review.
And as mayor, I will continue to be relentless in changing the culture of the police department to ensure that everyone in our city is treated equally.
In the US, there's a widely accepted 21-foot rule. Get closer and the police can fire. But is it time for a closer look at when and how authorities use deadly force? Joining me today with their analysis are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Michael Binion. Also ahead, it's election season in Britain, but is anyone that bothered?
There was a global financial crisis which caused the deficit to rise. President Obama isn't dealing with a high deficit because we built more schools and hospitals. He's dealing with a high deficit because there was that global financial crisis.
With fewer than 48 hours until polls open, Brits seem to be suffering a bout of nostalgia for a time when politics was a much more certain game. But is the idea of a political golden age just a myth? Plus, France's far-right family rift deepens for the Le Pens, and what's behind Francois Hollande's business interests in Saudi Arabia? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law, and also the author of What If Latin America Ruled the World, and also Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times here in London. Welcome both to the programme. In the US, the use of police force or bullets during arrests has recently led to civil unrest and rising racial tensions. But for those officers who are charged with upholding the law, there is a real issue here. When faced with a situation that could mean the difference between their lives and their deaths, at what point can they rightfully resort to using deadly force? After last week's mass riots that swept across the US city of Baltimore, some police are now calling for a rethink of official guidelines. Could this be a positive step to restoring public confidence? Michael, this is an interesting story. This is it's gone back to the 80s, this 21-foot rule. It seems to have been never really kind of, and everyone, it just happened. It didn't really kind of get passed into law. There seems to be a kind of feeling now that there should be situations when the police back off, when the police use more calming tactics rather than confronting people. Do you feel that we are at a moment in the US where this kind of debate will have some cut through?
I hope we are, because it's the time to do it. Crime rates have been falling in the US for at least 10 years. And in fact, streets in American cities are safer now than they've been for a very long time. So the worry that police are going to be overwhelmed by armed gangsters is considerably less than it was. On the other hand, it does look as though the police are just as trigger happy as they ever have been. And that decreases public confidence in policing, which is a bad thing. And I think the idea of more preventative policing, not simply reacting to violence, but trying to calm things before an event arises, is something the Americans have been a bit slow to adopt. Most other police services in the world are now quite adept at looking at ways of calming crowds and backing off before things developed. The Americans need to start doing that.
Oscar, certainly here in Europe, we've seen many police forces adopt these rules. In London, often it seems to be the idea is you let people leave the scene of a crime, you let them get away, and then you collect evidence and arrest them in your own good time. But in the US, there has been this kind of, you know, confrontational shoot first, you know, save your life kind of policy. Again, as you know, you know what happens in Latin America, but when you look north, does it concern you that shoot first, ask questions later kind of policy?
Absolutely. You lived in the United States for quite a while, and in the South in particular, and that sort of policy added to already existing tensions. And that's precisely what we have seen in Baltimore and other places. It is clearly obvious that the riots were not due solely to the kind of policing that is the subject of this conversation, but that certainly doesn't help. So As long as the police does change its culture, as the mayor of Baltimore said, and that entails not only a rethinking of these rules, but also of relations between the police and these communities that feel marginalized. If that happens, that's better for America. Absolutely, yes.
Michael, the New York Times carried a report today saying that in some instances, for example, in Oakland, where the police there had a terrible reputation for shooting people during these incidents, suddenly this year they've had a zero death rate. They've learnt new ways of policing, and often by backing off, they have rules now that you can't chase an assailant on your own in case you get cornered. Again, do you think it comes back to a rethinking of, what we expect in these situations? Because we're so used to watching these kind of American chase TV programs. You see live camera footage of, people being stopped, really confrontational tactics. Is it a whole culture change, as the mayor was saying there? You need a different kind of police force, a police force that sees itself much more in the role of being public servants.
Yes, I think that is the way it's going and the way it should go. And I think you're absolutely right in saying that the image has been actually forged by television shows and film shows and excitement and that kind of thing. And people have more or less conformed to what is the stereotype of this kind of confrontation. Show that they've got the guts to go in there and, stand up to violence and get the bad guys. And unfortunately, they tend to follow a pattern that is, frankly, just the creation of a kind of lively film producer. And that's obviously not the way policing should work. In Europe, to some extent, and certainly in Britain, police have had to learn the hard way, and especially in Northern Ireland, where they were confronted day in, day out with a section of the population that was upset, discontent, on the verge of violence, but needed to be calmed down by the police. excuse me. And the police did learn better tactics. And that's being applied across the board, not only in Northern Ireland, but in the rest of Britain. And as you say, it is becoming much more now a more sensitive, more socially responsive force, rather than simply fighting gangs of bad guys. They're having to deal with a whole lot of other things. Domestic violence, for example, where you don't need guns. You don't need to wade in there against the bad guys. You need to have people who are quite well integrated in the community that they're meant to be policing.
Oscar, a final thought on this. At the heart of the story is there are occasions when a police officer is going to need to pull his gun and potentially fire. This 21-foot rule, as we were discussing, has been kind of central to that. But again, do you think that we just have to change the narrative a bit so that it's not always it seems to be a black person at the end of the barrel?
The narrative needs to change, but for the narrative to change, reality must change on the ground. And the fact of the matter is that the police is dealing not with bad guys or gangs, not in cases such as the Baltimore riots. They were dealing with social movements, with communities of resistance. And to construe those as if they were just the bad guys who needed to be responded with full force is clearly the wrong approach.
Well, let's move on now to France, where the far-right National Front Party has won fewer Le Pen in its midst today, after the party's founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, was suspended by his daughter, the current leader, Marine Le Pen. The party elder says he still believes the Nazi gas chambers were a mere detail of history, and that he is ashamed his daughter continues to lead a party that carries his name. He also pointed out that he remains a member of the European Parliament and an elected official with considerable support in the south of France. Michael, a story I presume you know very well. When you watch this, what do you think is the central narrative that's being unfolded here? Is this an attempt by Marine Le Pen to create a party which has a much wider appeal, that has an air of respectability?
Yes, I think that is the main narrative. And to some extent, she's been very successful. And the National Front has begun to be taken as a sort of mainstream party and is posing quite a challenge to the centre-right party led by Sarkozy. But the old man is having none of it. I mean, he is an old diehard. And the other element to this story is really the King Lear narrative. The old man who passes the throne to his daughter, who then suddenly finds himself scorned and angry at being left out and is determined to make his comeback with some disastrous results, I may say. I mean, he has behaved quite abominably. His views are pretty shocking in any case. But the fact that he is attempting to deny the progress that the National Front has made electorally by denying its more moderate message shows that he really doesn't want to change his views at all.
And do you think, when you look at the, you know, the central issue around, you know, the Jewish question, Michael, you know, that why is that so important to, you know, the elder members of that party? Is it a genuine belief, you know, that is a mere detail of history, that it didn't happen? Are they in denial? Because they still seem to want to have some correction to, you know, Vichy France. They want to seem to rewrite history a little bit as well.
I don't quite know where that comes from. Yes, it's true. They do seem to be really obtuse and, I would say, frankly, electorally totally perverse in pursuing a line of kind of ideology that is so wholly at odds, not only with almost everybody else in France, but with everything the weight of history shows. I think it's possibly because the links go back to the generation that quietly collaborated with Vichy France and was ashamed of it, but doesn't really want to be branded as traitors, therefore needs to show that Vichy France wasn't really as bad after all as people are now saying it was. And there is still a residue of that generation, and he is one of that generation, he's of that age group, of people who were collaborators during the war, and therefore they need to slightly play down the horrors of Nazism, which he's obviously still trying to do.
Oscar, is this a good example of a populist European party actually kind of adapting to the times and, you know, ditching its kind of more extreme elements? You know, we see this across Europe. Here in France, we see a party that's actually very powerful now, part of the mainstream. Is this a new politics, do you think?
In fact, that's what worries me. Michael was absolutely right in saying that the Front National is becoming more respectable. We should emphasize the fact that this is a far-right kind of populism and not put it on the same sack with other formats. And if that is the case, then one wonders whether what we see in the case of the old Le Pen is kind of the hard kernel, the truth, the ugly truth rearing its head, and Marine Le Pen making an effort to sort of push it to the side in order to gain more respectability. And yet, the very fact that that symptom keeps coming back perhaps reveals that it is, as psychoanalysts say, the real.
Mike, when you look at all these parties, like the True Finns in Finland, Jobbik in Hungary, our own Mr. Farage, do you think there is an overlaying of sentiment that they all share? Or, you know, Mr. Farage was very good to say here in the UK when he went into the European Parliament, he didn't want really to kind of tie his kind of colours to Marine Le Pen. Do you think they're different sorts of populist parties, or are they all coming back to this central issue about immigration in the end?
Well, immigration is a common concern for virtually all of them. And I think they are different, yes. And the other common concern is a worry that each individual country has had its history more or less downplayed by being pushed together with other countries in the European Union. They're all pretty Eurosceptic, and to some extent they're all fairly nationalist, and they're all keen to drum up the lovely memories of a so-called glorious past. I mean, we see it in Hungary, we see it in not so much in Finland, but certainly in France. There's a sort of feeling that la gloire, you know, the glory days, need to come back, and I think that's common to all of them. There is a kind of appeal to sentiment. They do tend to appeal to older voters. I mean, it's not the kind of Nazi-type party which used to appeal to young radical voters. That's not really where these right-wing parties are coming from. They're coming much more from those who feel marginalised and from older voters who feel that times are changing and they don't like the changes.
Now, we know that some of this is, as we said, to do with immigration. Just sticking with you again, Michael, do you think that if the left had been better at debating some of these issues or bringing them into the mainstream, do you think it was because the central parties even left discussion of immigration so off the table that it gave room for these parties to kind of, you know, take over the debate in a way?
Oh, absolutely. And the absolute classic case of this is the Netherlands, where you had a very liberal political establishment where almost all the parties were determined to try to ensure that integration worked and that people were happy. But they didn't really listen to the fact that a lot of people said integration isn't working. And there are some Muslim groups who are forming rather separatist, hard-knit groups in our neighbourhood, and they're quite extreme in their views, and we don't like it. And then all of a sudden you got the murder of a right-wing politician, and suddenly the right in the Netherlands came roaring into the political debate in a way that nobody expected.
When you look at this, Oscar, you know, do you think that, you know, in the UK we're thinking UKIP may only take 12% of the vote, the popular vote, when we go to the elections on Thursday? Marine Le Pen much more successful. What do you put down to the reasons for their success?
Well, part of the reason is that, as you suggested, certain questions were left untreated. For instance, immigration, but also, perhaps more important, the whole orientation of the European project. And it is because of that that we are seeing these, frankly, quite ugly groups kidnapping those debates. That's the reason for their success. That's also the reason for this curious ambiguity, this blend of historical revisionism that appeals to an older generation and brings back forms of nationalism with concerns that have to do with whether one, you know, people here will lose their jobs and so on and so forth. That melange is exactly the same toxic mixture that we saw in the 1930s. And therefore, it should be responded much more firmly, particularly by the left.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, and Michael Binion. Coming up, despite its lethal reputation, Colombia's murder rate is actually on the decline. We'll look at why. Plus, as voting day draws closer, Brits mourn for a time when it was all so much simpler. But was it really? That's up next.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Michael Binion and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Well, coffee, drug cartels and the pop singer Shakira aren't usually things you'd place in the same category. But for Colombia, the struggle to move beyond that common international perception has proved difficult at times. Yet last year saw a massive decrease in murder rates for the country, with the lowest number since 2014. In some cities, numbers have fallen by nearly half so far this year. Oscar, what's behind the fall in the numbers?
Well, the point is that the fall has taken place in two main cities, Medellin and Cali, which were the points of not only the drug cartel wars, but also the surge of the far right paramilitary which were in cahoots and or emerged from the cartels. So the fact that the war is winding down is what accounts for these figures. Also, this shows that most of the violence that was taking place in Colombia until recently was coming from the far-right paramilitary rather than from the far guerrillas. If that is the case, then what needs to happen now is for the peace process to come to an end, to a positive end, and then for the government to tackle the remains, the remaining branches of the far-right paramilitary.
Michael, an amazing turnaround for Colombia. When you think about what its reputation was, you know, just a few years ago, people would just really not want to go there. Now you look at a city like Cartagena that was once, you know, riddled by drug crime. Is that one of the hottest places supposedly to go for your holidays? Even cities like Medellin suddenly, you know, fall in crime rates. Is this kind of a really great example of what can happen when you get people around the negotiating table?
Yes, I think it is. And I also have to say that Colombia has been lucky in that recently it's had a number of very good presidents who've been clear-sighted, who've been determined, who've had considerable backing from the United States and others to really see it through, but have been quite brave in their determination to try to continue along a reasonable course and to be ready for negotiation and also for a political compromise. Difficult to do when the thing was so polarized and when the lure of drug money was so strong. In a way, Colombia's looking back to a much earlier history. It is, after all, I think the oldest democracy in Latin America, or certainly one of the oldest, and has been very proud of its old democratic traditions, which seem to have just vanished for about 30 or 40 years. But it may be that they are drawing on old strengths and an old sense of a fairly civilized society that once was there, and which may yet reimpose its values.
Oscar, these stories of, you know, falling crime rates, it's the same in New York when people try to work out why suddenly the crime rate fell in New York. It's sometimes difficult to pinpoint the exact thing. With Colombia, do you think it's also the way that the drug trade has changed? Because you look at the US and people are taking synthetic drugs like methamphetamine. They don't need to be importing cocaine across all of these borders. In a way, the world has changed a little bit, you know, and we don't see these huge drug cartels so successful in Colombia. Or is it just that they've pushed the problem elsewhere? Because some people say, OK, Colombia's doing pretty well, but if you go across the border now to Peru, you'll find many of the gangs operating there instead.
Cocaine is still a huge business in Colombia and in the entire region. It is true that it has been displaced. It has moved to mainly to Mexico. But that's not probably the reason why we have seen this fall in homicide rates. As I was saying before, it has to do with the fact that Medellin and Cali were the cities where the paramilitary, who were former cartel members, concentrated. And as they were confronted, as the peace process makes them more irrelevant, they lose their hold. Also, it is the case that communities organized in these cities, and they began to push against this mixture of violence and business.
Well, we're going to return now to France in a way, because the French president, François Hollande, has been on a charm offensive in Riyadh, with France set to act quickly on a series of deals worth billions of euros, ranging from aviation and defence to transport and energy. The deal would be a clear sign of a cosy diplomatic relationship between the two countries. Michael, you know, this is every European leader seems to go on one of these tours and try and sign up as many deals as possible. The French have traditionally had a kind of a more kind of generous approach to selling arms in the region. It's his fourth trip, though, in recent years to Saudi. Why such an emphasis on that relationship?
Well, several things. First of all, France desperately needs the money, and François Hollande desperately needs some diplomatic success. Secondly, France has for some years benefited by not being the Anglo-Saxons, in other words, not American or British, and therefore not necessarily associated with unpopular policies that the Americans were wielding in the Middle East. Though I have to say, in Saudi Arabia, the Americans have always been seen as reliable allies. But France has always tried to sort of portray itself as slightly separate from them and played on that. Thirdly, I think the Saudis are in a mood to, whatever arms they can at the moment. They're in a slightly, I would say, almost paranoid frame of mind at the moment. They are engaged in a war in Yemen, which doesn't look as though it's going terribly well. They want to make quite sure that they're well supplied with arms. France needs to sell everything it can. If they could, they'd sell the battleship they built for the Russians, which now is in dry dock, I think, looking for a buyer because they've decided they can't really sell that to Moscow after the Ukraine affair. So the French are really pushing the trade for all they can. And of course, it's also always linked to the idea of France expanding its political and cultural influence in the Middle East, where in recent years they felt rather shut out by the Anglo-Saxons.
Oscar, we've seen them doing, you know, cultural plays and military plays also in the Gulf states, you know, setting up bases of both cultural and military nature. But when you look at the relationship with Saudi, Michael says, it comes at an intriguing time with this war going on in Yemen and many feeling that the attacks there have been, if not misguided, not the most well-directed of attacks on occasion. Do you think there is some kind of trickiness for France because so many people are critical of what Saudi's up to?
It is problematic because it's not just Saudi Arabia, it's also Qatar. And, it would be very difficult to justify issuing and selling arms to regimes which are not at all democratic. Clearly contradictory if you look at the democratic values that France is so proud of.
Well, we're going to cut to the UK now because we have a final juicy topic to end with, because it's less than 48 hours until the UK finally votes in one of the least certain elections in its history. With all polls pointing to yet another hung parliament, the bickering over who will or won't be doing a deal with which party seems unlikely to stop until the counting is finished. And even then, I think it will continue for a lot longer. But was there ever a golden age? Are we looking back to a time when we kind of knew who was going to win? Michael, we were just saying in the ad break there that actually the juicy bit is going to be after the election. I'm not sure if people are kind of disillusioned with the election process, but the polls just haven't moved at all, have they? It hasn't been the most... there's been no revelations. There's been no kind of moment where, you know, Mr. Prescott punched someone in the street. We just haven't had the excitement to galvanise us.
I can't remember an election campaign that's been as boring as this one. It really is interminably boring. Terrible. I can hardly bring myself to read the daily announcements because, firstly, the party leaders have nothing specific to offer, and what they do offer looks so transparently like a kind of cheap bribe that it really doesn't seem to have political weight. There's very little ideological difference between the two. Yes, on how you would run the health service, it's more about competence and that kind of thing. But equally, I can't imagine a time that's going to be more exciting than the day after the election, when we're going to see the most amazing bargaining and bickering. Now, that will be a time for real political intrigue.
Oscar, when you watch our electoral process here in the UK, what do you make of it? And do you find that actually this election has been dull as somebody who lives here now, but has been able to observe its politics from afar as well?
Not only has been boring, it is also a bit of a distraction. The whole narrative is not telling us what is really important about this. Obviously, if there is something crucial in this election is what is happening in Scotland, for instance. And yet that seems to be pushed under the carpet or rewritten as some sort of monstrosity. But actually, that's what is really different. Everything else, the polls, the fact that no party can command more than a third of the vote, but that's how it has always been. There hasn't been a golden age. If we were here in the 1810s here in London, we would see how the Westminster radicals were denouncing the parties of the time for corruption and running really boring campaigns. That's exactly what is happening. But the problem for me is the fact that the leaders are not talking to the people about the real issues. And that's the difference with what has been happening in Scotland. I used to live in Scotland in the 90s, and I've been following what has been happening there. And you can see why people there are fired up. Whether or not that will be positive for the day after the election, we'll see. But that's going to make it a lot different.
Michael.
That does actually take us straight back to the 1880s, when that was the last time we had a kind of ethnic bloc or regional bloc, was when we had the Irish Home Rule Group in Parliament, who are a large group of MPs from Ireland, and the only thing they were interested in was Home Rule for Ireland, and therefore they supported the Liberals or didn't support the Liberals, Gladstone's last administration, as to how much was in it for Ireland. Now, that's what we may see with the Scottish Nationalists. I think it is a most unusual situation, and I completely agree with Oscar. That's what's interesting about this election. We're having a kind of second run at the referendum on independence, if not now, certainly possibly later. And I think that is going to shake up British politics in a way we haven't seen before.
And Nicola Sturgeon has been at least a character. She's, you know, she's kind of fired up things in certain quarters. But if you were going to have a wager, have you had a wager? Are you going to reveal what you are?
No, I'm afraid I'm going with the conventional wisdom, is that the most likely outcome is probably a rerun of what we've got now, with the Conservatives slightly the larger party, not much, and the Liberal Democrats, though smaller, still providing an essential coalition partner, so we get the same as what we had before.
But it's going to be a lot harder for them to maintain their
harder,
coalition.
Much harder.
We're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. That was Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Michael Binion. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. And that's all we have time for today. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan, researched by Fernando Agosto-Pacheco and Sarah Mineta. And our studio manager was Sean Mulleverry. And for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye.